This is our last session or last class in session two. And so one of the things that I want to do today is, in addition to the kind of typical review, kind of big picture view, because I think it's important to keep a sense of the whole. I guess that's fits in pretty well with inhabiting the whole. So we're inhabiting the whole of this 12-week session here. I do want to do that and then go on to the theme for today, which I hope in some ways will kind of bring everything together in a very beautiful, complete sense. And then talk a little bit about going forward, how I'm thinking about that after this course. Okay. So let's take a look at where we are. Way back at the beginning of the first course, I talked about the problem that we are cut off from the world, cut off from ourselves. We don't feel at home. To use that image again, we're like aliens, you know, who are in the world, but we're always afraid that somebody's going to challenge our right to be here, in a sense. Now, that may not be a way of describing it that works for each of you, but I'm sure there's something in that that resonates with your experience. So I hope you can inquire and find it for yourself. Now, when you start to look at that in terms of space, and we looked at this early on, what you can say is that we really don't inhabit space, but that's not what we said early on. We talked about the fact that we don't really even have access to space, that space has disappeared. And that's a way that Rinpoche talks about it in Dynamics of Time and Space. Our ordinary understanding of space, first of all, just confines it to the physical realm. And that is so well established that I always feel that that's a kind of a sticking point, a difficulty for people who come to the TSK vision and you say, well, space is more than just the physical. And they say, well, wait a minute. No, that's what space is. It's all about the physical realm. And we've been exploring the ways in which that's not the case. In which space is the space that we inhabit. And again, I'm coming to that word. I find it very useful, I guess. We inhabit space, and that means that we inhabit it with all of our human capacities, and space allows all of those capacities. But the ordinary view is, first of all, it's physical, and second of all, there's nothing there. There's nothing to say about space. It's just the distance between the things we care about, you know, in terms of the physical realm. Only the things that show up in space are real, and the self is real, but that's problematic because the self doesn't occupy space. It's not an object in space. You know, the body is an object in space, you could say, but the self is not, and so we don't know how to bridge the gap between the self and the world. You know, in philosophical terms, you'd say we are by inclination, as human beings, you could say, we're dualists, right? We there's the self on one side and the world on the other side, and it becomes a big problem how to bring the two together. Now, that would be a philosophical way of describing it, and we don't need to worry too much about the philosophical arguments, which are extensive, that, you know, that gets discussed a lot in the Western tradition, in those terms. But existentially, it's true. You know, existentially, we're just different from everything else. And we assume that other human beings and other sentient beings kind of come down on our side of the divide. Mostly that's how we think about it, even though we say that, you know, we're special, you know, my case is a special case, but in some respects I share with other human beings and sentient beings. And then there's that whole inanimate world. That's our usual way of talking about it or thinking about it. So it's this kind of existential divorce. You know, we're born into the world, and already from the moment we're born, we're divorced. You know, we're cut off. It's a problem. So what we've been looking at is that we can, how to recover space, how to really be in the world, and how space can support that. And we do that by inhabiting space. And when we inhabit space, we can find ourselves at home. You know, we can feel like we really are not separated, not cut off. We can be fully present. And when we're fully present, the world that we're present in, the space, what space discloses, is very different. You know, it becomes a very different and more fulfilling world. It makes sense because we get to inhabit it now. So one of the keys in understanding that, and I'm just kind of reviewing at this level, one of the keys to understanding that, and more and more as we've gone along, I've just been struck by how important it is multidimensionality. Space is not only physical, and then you say, what else is it? You say it has all these different dimensions, and those dimensions are human dimensions. You know, space is part of our human experience, although that may not be the best word. It's not as though, you know, our bodies inhabit space, and then the rest of us is all has to do with the mind, which is not spatial. Now, the whole, you know, space allows, has all these different dimensions. So, you know, the dimensionality of space is the dimensionality of human being. So when we look at that and we say, well, how can we inhabit space in a way that really allows for our whole, our wholeness, we end up talking about things like stories and meanings, the meanings that, you know, we live in a meaningful world. We live in a world that has been given meaning through the stories that that we live in. The more stories, you know, it's kind of like a character in a movie, right? The character only gets to be a character because it inhabits the world of the movie, or the same thing in dreams. But that's the way it is in our waking life too. You know, the world is not mechanical. You know, it's when you talk about artificial intelligence, which is a kind of a big topic. I don't want to really get into it, but you'd say, why is it artificial? Why do we call it artificial? Well, partly because it's made. It's made by us. But I'd say if you want to describe the difference, you could say it doesn't have this sense of inhabiting a meaningful world. It doesn't have its own story, you know. And we do. So we've been looking at that, and we started with a focus more on physical space, so that we could really question the structure of having a self on the one side and things or objects on the other side. So we looked at distance and separation and location, and that really led us more toward the field of experience and the sense that the field inhabits, that the field, you know, we're always engaging the whole of the field. Okay, I think that's plenty of review. But I'm still going to be covering ground that we've touched on for a few minutes. I want to do it in terms of what you could think of as three levels of inhabiting, maybe. These are not three levels that Rinpoche talks about, but the three levels that we've talked about. I haven't put it quite that way before. And I actually want to use the example that that I used in week six of the first session. I see that Sudhi has a question, so let me come to that. She asks the question, what does it mean? What counts is the rhythms of time. Where does that come from? Sudhi, are you? Yeah. And why do you bring it up now? Has it just kind of been bothering you, or and you this is an occasion? Well, I think to go into it, let me say two things. One is I think that I've always found the whole notion of rhythms of time that Rinpoche does talk about in various places is challenging for me personally. I'm more of a space guy. Let me try to put it into the context that we are engaging right now. And it kind of goes in, it might make a little more sense when I've gone into what I was going to next, but I think it's okay. David, by the way, offers something. He says, day into night, season to season, et cetera, rhythm. Yeah, I think that's certainly on one level, that's exactly right. But I do want to point to something a little different. So we're talking about stories, and as soon as you have a story, you have temporality. So you have things unfolding from past to present to future. You have that kind of linear temporality, right? And I think this is this exercise 10 in the TSK book? Okay, well, I don't want to go too far into it, so I'll just stay with what you said. There's a difference between time as it unfolds in the story, in which case we're very committed to the content of the story, which is kind of the, as we were saying last week or the week before, the content is the thought dimension. You know, thought gives us the content of what's going on. So there's that kind of linear temporality, and I think from what the quote you read, Rinpoche is saying essentially there is a different dimension of time than the linear temporality, and if we can connect with the rhythms of time, which is more the dynamic, and I just read something, I suppose it was, I don't know, it must have been one of the TSK books just yesterday, that said, there's a rhythm. It's a rhythm that doesn't depend on movement. It's more of an aliveness or a dynamic. And I think when you connect with that, you're not so connected to the story. You're not so dependent on the story. So that's what I'm going to say right now. It will come up in a way. Maybe I can refer to it a little more as we go forward. A couple of other people have offered thoughts. So there are rhythms, so David talked about the rhythm of the seasons and you know, the physical world, you could say. And he also said emotional cycle. Sorry, I left that out. Eliana says the rhythms of the breath. And David also added the beating of the heart. So there are all these places where we can encounter rhythm. And then Michael says rhythm is more fundamental than counting. And without time cycling, counting would be unthinkable. And he gives an example of cycling of time, the rain drumming on a tin roof, which is interesting. I was struck. The quote, it says, what counts is the rhythm of time. And Michael points to that also. He says rhythm is more fundamental than counting. Usually counting leads toward accounting, giving an account. And then we're in the realm of the story, right? And then we're in the content of the story. And I think the rhythm is more fundamental than that, exactly. And, you know, the examples that people have given, which are great, it's always good. It's always helpful for me to be kind of reminded of the immediacy of what we're talking about, rhythms of time. You know, it's the beating of the heart. It's the rhythms of mood, Hayward adds. It's the breath. All these places where there's a kind of a rhythmic structure. I think what I would say about that, though, is I'd refer it back to the very beginning of the first TSK book, where he says, that's the sky. Remember, it starts off something like, wherever we go, whatever we do on this crowded surface of interactions we call the earth, above us is the sky. And then he says, the sky is like the local representative of space. And that works on a very kind of straightforward level, because the sky is not, it's not separated from space. You go up into the sky and out and out and out and out, and you find yourself in empty black space, but it also works in the sense, I think, that when we engage the openness of the sky, we're tuning in to the openness of space. And I think the examples that people have been given are like that. If we tune in to the rhythm of the beating of the heart, or the rhythms of mood, or all of these examples people have been giving, we're tuning into the dynamic of time. But the dynamic is more fundamental. The rhythm is more fundamental. But David said, human space, he's quoting something. Human space is much richer than physical space. Okay. Because human beings enjoy a much richer range of possibilities than things do. Maybe he's not quoting something. Okay. That person knew what he was talking about. Okay, thanks. human space is much richer than physical space because human beings enjoy a much richer range of possibilities than things do. Exactly, yeah. Human beings can feel, think, enjoy, fear, hold beliefs, maintain values, and much more. And that goes to the issue of dimensionality. So you're bringing us back to that issue of multidimensionality. I think that's right. And I'm trying to stay connected to what Sudhi was asking about the rhythms of time. When you turn time into a story, you kind of automatically, not completely, but you tend to lose the multidimensionality. Stories so easily turn into plots, where you just say one thing happens and then another happens and then another happens, and you explain how they're connected, but you're missing the multidimensionality, the richness, the aliveness, and the rhythms of time bring us in contact with that. And Michael says, David's observations, I guess the quote, invoke the human space from which they emerge. Yeah, like a bird flying out of a forest. What a nice image. I'm glad we have all these creative thinkers and writers among us. Okay, I want to go back now to what I was starting to say about three different levels, which is still kind of on the level we're still kind of reviewing where we've been, but it'll be a transition, I think, to where I want to take us. So I want to use the image that I used or mentioned in week six of the first course that I borrowed from Margaret Wheatley. You remember she talks about someone who meets these three bricklayers. And the first bricklayer says, when he's asked the question, what are you doing? He says, I'm laying bricks. And the second bricklayer says, I'm building a wall. And the third bricklayer says, I'm building a cathedral. Right? And when I talked about that back in week six, I said, all of those are actually can really express our embodiment and our engagement in space. Although that's not the way that she talks about it. I want to go back now to the way that she talks about it. So we have to kind of imagine these three bricklayers. They have to become characters in our story, right? So the first bricklayer is, you imagine, he answers, I'm laying bricks. And he's an unhappy person. He's unhappy because he's just doing a job. He's just a day laborer, as we would say. He's just being paid to do this. He's not connected to what he's doing. Now, of course there are other ways of laying bricks. That's what we talked about before. But if we think of that character, the person who is cut off from what they're doing and just kind of, mechanically performing their job, that's someone who doesn't inhabit space, right? That's like the outsider who's just doing the job. And I think we all have the experience of interacting with people in a kind of a business or commercial setting who are just doing their job, and they don't engage you as a person. One practice, if you want to think about this as a walkabout, one practice that I've tried for really quite a long time is I try to engage the people I meet just in casual situations, like at the supermarket, and very often they're just doing their job. They don't want to engage you. They don't want to inhabit the space in which you and they are interacting. But sometimes they do. And when they do, you feel like you're connecting with a human being. It brings things alive. So that's the first situation where you don't inhabit space at all. You're kind of in your own private realm, and you don't acknowledge being. You don't acknowledge being here. Now, the second example, the person who's building a wall, you could imagine that person is more of a crafts person, someone who has the possibility of taking pride in what they're doing, of doing a really good job. Someone who is, how shall we say this, who is inhabiting the story. I guess that's what I really want to say. So they're, they've got this story. I'm building a wall. That's what I'm doing today. And that story is potentially, if you think of it as somebody who takes pride in their work, it's very fulfilling, very satisfying, but it's the story of the self. And it's always possible for that story to head off in the direction of emotionality. If obstacles come up, for instance, in the work that you're doing, just to take an example. The third example this is the one that's going to lead us to where I want to really go today, is the person who says, I'm building a cathedral. And I think we're meant to imagine that person as someone who's inspired by the vision of what they're doing, right? And at this point, it makes sense to say they're inhabiting the whole of the space they're in. That is, everything they're doing is shaped by this vision of the wonderful cathedral. You know, of course, in practice, I mean, if you think of this, always makes me think that it happened in the Middle Ages, and you know, it took centuries to build cathedrals. So in all that time, you probably sometimes got fed up, right? But and didn't care so much. But if you imagine that person in the moment of being inspired by the vision of the cathedral that's coming into being, that's what I want to call the realm of intention. You could say inspiration. There are many things you could say, but I'm going to talk about it in terms of intention for reasons that I think will become clear. So this third level is, for me, it's kind of the answer to a question. And the question is, how do you really inhabit the whole? You can do it in terms of the story. And we've talked about inhabiting the story of the whole. When you do that, then you are in the realm of moods and emotions and so on, because the story is always being shaped partly by that. And that's the kind of, you could say, the real level of the story, going a little bit more toward the rhythms of time. Hayward gave the example of the rhythm of moods, you know, but that's what you're doing when you're involved in, when you're inhabiting a world which is based on story, or can we say grounded in stories, and in particular grounded in the founding story, which is the story of the self, the here I am. Yeah. If you can go beyond the story of the self, then you can go beyond that realm of emotionality, of, you know, kind of potential, at least, emotionality, and you can go toward love, devotion, caring. So we're talking in, you know, those are terms that don't come up so often in the TSK vision, but they do, for instance, at the end of the first TSK book, and they do in various places throughout the books. When we go beyond the self story, and really ultimately when we go beyond stories, not in the sense that stories disappear, but in the sense that that's not what we care about. You know, we don't care about We need to know about the story, but we don't. That's not what matters. So the image that comes to mind right now is one that Rinpoche uses in one of his early books, not a TSK book, where he talks about a woman, an older woman, who stops in a park and watches children playing, and they're playing a game, and it's some sort of, you know, they're playing football or something. And they're very caught up in the story, who's winning, who's losing, and so on. But she's just enjoying their joy, their excitement, their involvement, their aliveness. You could say that points towards the rhythm of time, right? Rather than the content. It's like that. We, you know, she understands that it's all about playing football. She, you know, she's not unable to appreciate the story, for us as a story, but it's not what matters. She's inhabiting a whole that is broader than any of that. Yeah. And that can come up, as I say, in many different ways. The way that this, the example that I'm using is in terms of a vision or an intention or inspiration. So when I say intention, because that's the one I kind of want to focus on, it's the intention to participate in the building of this cathedral. And that intention, if it has the potential, let's say, to pervade the whole. We've talked off and on about pervasion, right? In other words, everything that you do contributes to that whole. Everything, that's not even a strong enough way of saying it. I don't know a better way to say it than pervasion. You know, when you take, you're building the cathedral and you take a lunch break, you know, but the lunch break also contributes, you know, what you eat for lunch also contributes. It's all part of what you're doing. I'm sure people have had the experience of working in projects, with other people where it kind of comes alive and everything that's going on, even the really trivial stuff, is in some ways touched by the underlying vision, the whole of what's going on. So the intention, you know, if you think of it in terms of space, you could think of it as kind of holding space open, like when you're building when you're setting up a tent and you put up a pole in the middle, and then that holds open the space, you know. The intention is kind of like that. It holds open space. Now, it's always possible for that intention to turn into a story about me, you know, and then now we're back into the realm of emotionality. It's a kind of a distorted version of intentionality. And the difference is that the emotional level supports the founding story, and intention transforms that story toward the whole openness of space, right? It's not about me, as we say. So the quality of, we start off, you could say, with a thought, right? And then that thought becomes a story. But when we bring in this quality of really caring about something that goes beyond the story, now we're at the level of intention. And there's so many ways to do that. You know, the vision example here is one, the being inspired by the vision of the cathedral. We've talked about the others, devotion, faith, love, so many. So when we do that, we really bring space fully alive. I think a helpful example of that is if you think of the relationship between a parent and a child. You know, when the child is born, the parent's world is transformed, right? The world, the presence of that child, I'm talking in kind of ideal terms, but I guess we often do, the presence of the child pervades the space of that world. Everything is now different, right? And that has to do with the quality of love, which opens the world beyond the story of the self. Now, it can turn back into self stories, you know, and I mean, I don't want to go into all of that, but you know, the moment you start being concerned and worrying, which is natural, but you know, that has to do with, in a way, it has to do with the fact that your story has been expanded. So it's no longer just a story of the self. It's a story of my family, you know. It's still the same kind of structure, but the underlying love, and again, that goes back in a sense to the difference between the content of the story and the unfolding rhythm of time. The underlying aliveness becomes available through the intention. So There's a way to talk about that. Well, okay. Basically, I want to have us do some practice with that for a moment. And mostly because, well, for a few minutes, mostly because I want to help clarify. I think we can help clarify what this involves. When you move from the realm of emotion to what I'm calling the realm of intention, but you could also call it the realm of caring, say, then you move into a kind of a relationship of wholeness with space. But it's not as though, you leave your old world behind. You start where you are, you start with your own the world you find yourself in with, you start with your concerns and just your situation as it is. And within that, you look for this quality of intention and you let it pervade the whole. So there's a nice quote. I started looking at exercise 25 in Dynamics of Time and Space. It's the last exercise. And it's not, if you look at it, and I think it's good in this context to look at it, but it's not talking the way we're talking. It's what's it actually called? It's called Enlightening Knowledge. But if you read it, it'll give you kind of a flavor, I think, that is relevant to what we're talking about. But I'm not going to go into it too much, but at the very end of the exercise or the commentary on the exercise, he says, drawing on our own mind and senses and feelings, we can open the heart of space and enter the depth of time. What starts as an idea discloses its availability at the center of all that is. And I thought that was very lovely. What starts as an idea discloses its availability at the center of all that is. And that notion of availability at the center of all that is, I think is another way of talking about, or at least very closely related to, the sense of pervading the whole of space. So we start with our own concerns, our own, let me look again, what did it say? We draw on our own mind and senses and feelings, and that includes then the story that is shaping our world right now. We bring all that in, and then we look for the quality of intention. And what I have in mind now when I say intention is, what takes us beyond ourselves? What is it that we care about deeply right now? So it may well have to do with some specific situation. There may be something that concerns you, but not just your personal concern. It's a little hard to make the distinction because I mean, to describe the distinction, because it depends a lot on your own situation, but something that takes you beyond yourself, something you really do care about. And that's the practice that I'd like us to do. It's kind of an open practice. The idea is ask yourself, what is it that you care about right now that takes you beyond yourself? What is an intention? An aspiration, an inspiration, a caring that takes you beyond the story of the self. And just let that intention pervade the whole of your experience, the whole of space. Let's try that and see if that's described adequately. So, it's not like an intention that you think it's an intention you should have, like, oh, I want to benefit all beings. That's great if that's what you're feeling, but you know, you start at the center of where you are, you know, and go from that. Okay, let's try that for a few minutes, okay? Okay. Okay, so Well, I'll just wait for other people. There's already a couple of comments. One or two date back or from before we did the exercise. Let me say one thing, just coming out of my own experience with doing this just now. It's not as though if you turn to an intention that goes beyond the self, you let go of the concerns of the self. You're really starting where you are. But there's a kind of a natural, letting the intention fill the whole of the space that you inhabit means you're also letting it fill your concerns, your worries, your limitations, your doubt. All of that is also pervaded by this more fundamental intention. And it's when you can practice with that kind of intention, I think, that you are moving toward awareness. You're moving toward a deeper knowledge. Okay. Now, Hayward wrote before we practiced, he just had the comment. I don't know the context anymore, but it works in all possible contexts, Hayward. He said, more open ways of being. Yeah. And Sudhi says, perhaps even what Joseph Campbell, this was also before we practiced, perhaps even what Joseph Campbell echoed by mythology and the bigger story from the story of the self is very relevant to what you're saying. So that's an interesting and big topic. I think in the end, we are talking about something that is not based on stories, any stories, but stories that go beyond the self in that sense, mythology religious, well, I'll use the word myths for now. I don't mean it in a negative sense at all. That can be helpful. That can be an important step, it seems to me. Okay, now some comments related to the practice. Michael says, there seem to be two parallel ways of engaging the whole, opening to the vistas of the TSK vision and other inspiring visions, and opening to the cathedrals under construction in our world. That's very nice. Exercising our gifts in meaningful ways seems an important ingredient in any fulfilling life. Right. So if we talk about multidimensionality and we say the dimensions that we're talking about are not so much space dimensions, space accommodates them, but human dimensions. And ultimately, there is this dimension in human life which asks, what do I truly care about? What can I contribute? What is meaningful in this life of mine? And so I think multidimensionality, expands out and out and out and in and in and in, until we touch our innermost self. And I think maybe the quote I think I just read this, didn't I? Maybe not. Yeah, I did. I did. That's right. I'm going to read it again from Dynamics at the end when he says, what starts as an idea discloses its availability at the center of all that is. And I said that that sense of being at the center of all that is another way of saying that it pervades the whole of what is. And so, what starts as an idea, not a thought, I don't think you can say a thought, but what starts as a vision, and then you can say idea in that sense, that can become available at the center of and throughout all that is. Okay. Ileana says, an intention of having balance and harmony points beyond the self and makes me feel more open and connected to everything around. Okay. Well, that's great. Thank you for giving us a specific example, Ileana, to work with. And you know, if you start with that sense of balance and harmony, and your intention is to let those be present, and that pervades the whole of space, then that affects, you know, the kind of facts of your life, you know, the things that are going on in your life. It manifests in the specifics. That's all I'd add. Great. And David says, intend to be more fully present to daily experience. Well, that's related, or at least parallel to what Eliana said. To be more fully present to daily experience, which allows the natural flavors of what is happening, their full expression, their multidimensional play. Less dependence on the artificial additives. I'm not quite sure what you have in mind, but I kind of get the flavor. And Lee says, experiencing the self as an instrument of the whole. Okay, so that's it's interesting. Again, it's starting with a kind of vision, going back to Michael's very nice image of, you know, what are the cathedrals that are being built in the world? And you could say, what are the cathedrals you build in your own mind as best you understand? So experiencing the self as an instrument of the whole feels organic, appropriate, and correct, as opposed to the experience of being a bystander in a world, which feels more like a mistaken identity, right? Yeah, I was looking at something Rinpoche wrote, it's not published, where he uses the word outcast. And I thought that's actually a pretty interesting term, that it's for bystander, you could say. You know, we live in the world like outcasts. In English, it's kind of a nice word. I mean, I think its origin is in the caste system of India. That's how we started talking about it. Someone who doesn't belong to any caste or who's excluded from a caste. But you could also say, to evoke a very different tradition, you know, being cast out in the way that Adam and Eve were cast out of the Garden of Eden. You know. That's kind of a funny place to end the course. but you know, living as outsiders, as bystanders, as outcasts, yes. So we get trapped in this identity. Very fundamentally, we get trapped in this sense of not being at home in space. So I want to mention just maybe one more thing, and what I want to mention is that if you say, if you say, well, what is my intention? What is it that takes me beyond myself? There is a risk, you could say, if you identify something, the risk is that you will start making judgments and you say, oh, well, I'm really in touch with that, or no, I'm not in touch with that. I'm not doing a good job. You know, I'm failing to maintain my own intention, my own commitment. And then we catch ourselves up in all these stories that go on and on and on and on and on. And one of the things that's really important about the TSK vision, I think, and David touched on it in his comment, is if you have the intention to develop your understanding, your knowledge, to question what's happening, then there is no such thing as failing. You know? There is no such thing. If that's your intention, and I'm not saying that should be your intention, but if you're, you know, if you've come this far in these courses, then in some sense that inspires you. And if you can touch on that inspiration, then you don't have to be concerned, you know, am I doing it right? Am I doing it wrong? Whatever happens, the possibility for inquiry is there. And that's why I think it's so important that, you know, the title of the second book in the TSK series is Love of Knowledge, because this quality of love, in a sense, it manifests most cleanly, most purely when we talk about love of knowledge, because then there are no limits. You know, whatever happens, the potential, the possibility for knowledge is there. Okay, well, let me just say a sentence or two about where we go. So we're not going to do any more classes, I think probably for the rest of the year. I'm going to be leading this retreat in Germany, and I know Karin's going to be there, but I don't think anybody else is. And in the retreat, I want to be exploring some of these same themes. And then based on that, I would really like to develop an approach to, I'd like to develop a way of presenting TSK that is accessible to people. As you know, I've been working in that direction for, trying to work in that direction for a long time. And that's one reason why, we did this whole 12-week sequence with very, very few references to the TSK books, because the books are just difficult for people. So I'm exploring how to present things. Now, maybe some of what we've talked about is difficult too. So I want to keep simplifying it without losing the heart of it. So the retreat will be an occasion for exploring that, and then I want to continue to work with that. And I'm thinking that probably in January I'll start something up again. I might try to do a live class that would be integrated with an on with online. I'm not sure yet. I'm just thinking about that. So there are a couple of notes here from people saying thank you, which I really appreciate. David says, well, I'm not going to read them. I'm too thank you. I really do. Oh, you're coming, Lee? Good. That's great. I'm really glad you're going to be there. Okay. In Germany, Lee says he's coming to the retreat. So maybe I just thought of this now, and I don't want to quite promise it, but maybe after the retreat is over, I'll just write a little note to everybody on how, what came out of it. And maybe Lee and Karin would like to do that too. That's related to what we've been exploring. So, well, I always learn a lot from these courses, and I really appreciate the opportunity. So thank you, everybody, and we will stay in touch.